Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi, dhammaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi, saṅghaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Dutiyampi buddhaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi, dutiyampi dhammaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi, dutiyampi saṅghaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Tatiyampi buddhaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi, tatiyampi dhammaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi, tatiyampi saṅghaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. So nice to see everybody here today, Friday evening. And I usually joke with people that this is our Friday evening party. So it was kind of funny. The other day I was at a temple and a very senior monk kind of came up to me. And I paid respects to him. Actually, I paid respects to him first. Then later he came up to me. And he started telling me this story. He said, you know, one time I was in Detroit and I got invited to a function with this other monk who's from Bangladesh. And he said, we went to the function and it was all these really elite people in Detroit, these really rich people. And he said, when we got there, somebody greeted them. And first thing they did was they took them to the bar. And they said, whoa, we can't do this, you know, don't drink, you know. And so the guy said, okay. And so he took them to the buffet. And it was afternoon. So they said, no, we can't go to the buffet. And so, you know, we took them a third time to the dance floor. And so when they took them to the dance floor, he said, no, we can't we can't dance. And then the guy said, what kind of life are you living? No beer, no food afternoon, no dancing. But this is the kind of way that in Buddhist practice, this is the kind of way that we, I guess, party. Kind of do our, instead of dancing, instead of, you know, as lay people can eat afternoon, but as monks can eat afternoon. Instead of eating a big meal, going out for a feast, instead of drinking alcohol, come to meditate and sit with our eyes closed. And so this is an interesting thing because people have been doing this for thousands of years, meditating with their eyes closed, almost no sensory contact, and yet even in the time of the Buddha, the King Bimbisara, I think it was, said, you know, it's amazing that kind of, he was exclaiming that monks seem really happy, very happy people, you know. And yet there's no dance floor, no bar, no eating afternoon, and there's, you know, more than 200 other things as well. And so the way that this came about was quite interesting. We're about to celebrate Vaisakh, which is the birth, which celebrates the birth, the enlightenment, and also the parinibbana of the Buddha. So this lifestyle, this kind of meditation, refraining from things, all comes about through the experiences of the Buddha. All comes about through the teachings of the Buddha. And so as Vaisakh approaches, I'm sure all you guys know about the life of the Buddha, but for the benefit of my mother, who might not know, I thought that I would talk a little bit about it. So actually, you know, most of the time we have this idea, especially in the West, at least growing up, that if I get this thing, once I get it, get that thing, I'll be happy. I'll be good. The trouble with it is that the thing that we want to get tends to keep receding into the distance. So first it's, oh, I want to do really well on this test. But then the test ends and another test comes. And it's, I really want to do well on this test. And then that test ends and it's, I really want to do well at the end of the year. And then it's, I really want to get a good grade in high school so that I can go to university. then it's, I really want to get a good GPA. And then it's, I really want to get a good job, a good promotion, a good house, yeah, a nice husband or wife, have children who are very healthy, and retire well. And then it's, I want to have a good death. So in other words, this goal keeps receding into the distance. Interesting thing was, in the time of the Buddha, he was actually born as a prince. So actually, there's nowhere in the canon where it explicitly says he was a prince, but he was at least born into a very, very wealthy family, and to the extent that he had three different houses, one for each season. And he was basically showered with sensual, you know, whatever kind of sensual pleasures you could get as a king or as a prince. He basically had them. His father was so wealthy and influential. And even the legend goes for various Buddhas, although it's not explicitly stated for ours, that his father, when he was born, had some seers come. This part is explicitly stated. And the seer said, "This, your son is going to be a Buddha." The seer said that. His name was Asita. And then the father, this part is not explicitly said in the canon, it said that he tried to hide his son from all the sufferings in life, because he didn't want him to leave the world and become a Buddha. He wanted him to stay in the world and become what's called a wheel-turning monarch, or a king who conquers the whole world. And so the legend goes that the Buddha went through life like this, basically totally enjoying sensual pleasures. But then one day he was out with his driver, and he saw an old person. And when he saw this old person, he said, "What's wrong with this old person? What's wrong with that man? He doesn't look like other people." And his driver said, "That's an old person." And then the Buddha said, "You know, will that happen to me too?" And his driver said something like, "Yes, you know, there's nobody who can escape getting old." So then the Buddha went back to the palace, and he was kind of disconcerted. And then his driver took him out another day, another time, and he saw a sick person, just kind of, I guess, lying, very sick. You know, they didn't really necessarily, and not everybody had a hospital bed at that time. So if you got sick and you were poor, you might just be out in the street, kind of lying in, you know, your own sickness, your own mess. And so he saw a sick person like this, and possibly like this, and he asked his driver, he said, "What's wrong with this man? What's going on with him?" And his driver said, "That's a sick person." And the Buddha said something like, "Well, will this happen to me? Has this happened to me?" And he said, "Well, yes, that's going to happen. Nobody can escape sickness." And so then Buddha went back, he's kind of feeling a bit disconsolate. And then he went a third time with his driver out on another occasion. And guess what he saw this time? A dead person. And so the same conversation apparently repeats itself. Yeah. "What's wrong with this man?" "Well, that's a dead person." "Yeah. Oh, will this happen to me?" "Yes, this will happen to me, or you too. Nobody can escape this." And so by now the Buddha's feeling very disconsolate. And so then the fourth time they went out for another outing, and you know what he saw? He saw a samana, a renunciate. He left the world. His faculties, I think, were pure and bright. He looked at ease. And he said to his drivers, maybe something like, "Who is this man?" His driver said, "That's a samana. He's searching for the deathless." And so then the Buddha realized that's what he wanted to do. So the legend goes, I think one of the legends was his wife had just given birth to his son that day. And he went back. This is what happened to another Buddha, Vipassi. But it's not explicitly stated it happened to ours, but this is the legend. And he went back, and that night, you know, he went back and he'd never even seen his son. And he opened the door and he saw his wife lying there with his newly born son. And he left without being able to hold his son or to see his son, talk to his son for the first time. He left and cut his hair and beard, became a samana. And so what this all shows is that the Buddha's desire, it's kind of, this is an ideal in Buddhism, it shows that as good as we can make it, as good as the world is, as good as nice houses, a nice grade is, all these things can make it, the true problem that binds all of us together as living beings, just this old age, sickness, and death. And it would be, this is one of the reasons why early missionaries thought Buddhism was very pessimistic, because it seems to always be talking about old age, sickness, death. And that would be pretty pessimistic if that was our only option. But the rest of the Buddha's life is meant to show that there were other options available. If there wasn't something deathless, there would be no escape from death, no escape from sickness, no escape from old age. But since there is the unconditioned, there is an escape from these things. And so the Buddha set out to find that escape. It's what he left home for, what he became a samana for. And so on becoming a samana, he went out and he started to try to find teachers. So he first found a couple of teachers and started practicing what's called the jhanas under them. He started to learn to do these two formless jhanas, states of concentration, but realized that those didn't lead to the deathless. So then next he went off and started practicing what's called austerities. And in ancient India at that time, they had these groups of people. This kind of cultural idea coalesced that originally the Brahmins had said that karma was something that you did by doing these very specific rituals, that they were like the only ones who could do. So you want to get into heaven, you have to go to a Brahmin. The Brahmin will do the right ritual for you. And if you accumulate enough of these rituals, that's your karma. And if you go to the Brahmins enough, accumulate enough good karma, you go to heaven. So there was a reaction against this, because you can imagine these Brahmins just totally dominating the spiritual life of India, charging a lot of money, and saying you're going to not make it to heaven unless you do our ritual. So there's a reaction against this, where people left the home life, left the Brahmanical fold, and tried to find a way out of rebirth on their own. So there were various ways that people tried to do this, and one of them was through what they call austerities or self-mortification. So people would basically have the idea that any form of happiness, any form of good feeling, was something that bound you to the cycle of rebirth. So people would try all kinds of things. Did you guys learn about any of the ones they tried back then? Yeah. Sometimes, yeah. Sometimes they would eat just one grainful, I think one handful of rice a day, one handful of rice a week, one handful of rice a fortnight. Yeah. Sometimes they would sit in front of fires in the middle of the Indian sun, just sitting there. Sometimes they would break their arms or legs and leave them to grow at an odd angle. And sometimes they would wear really unusual clothing, like antelope hide or bark. Sometimes people would wear shirts made out of hair because it was just so uncomfortable. And some people would go around, not clothed at all, just staying in the hot sun. And some would sleep on beds of nails. All these different things, basically with the idea that any form of pleasant feeling is something that would bind you to the cycle of rebirth. So then the Buddha took this up with a group of five friends, kind of took up these ascetic practices. And he even seemed to do some that weren't in the usual list. So he would even sometimes, if his excrement wasn't fully digested, he would eat that. And he would, he just kept fasting, basically denying himself any form of sensual pleasure. And he did this to the point where when he would rub his arms, his hair was so rotted that it would fall out. And if he touched his stomach, he would touch his spine. He became that thin. And there's kind of a saying where Mara, who's kind of like the devil, comes to the Buddha and he says, look, 1,000 parts of you are dead. Only one part is alive. Why don't you live? that shows kind of how far he'd gone. He was practicing all these austerities. And then the thought came to him, as painful as feelings people can feel, they can only equal these painful feelings. There's no feelings more painful than this. At best, they can only equal it. But I still haven't been freed from birth and death. And then he remembered a time when he was young and he was at his father's plowing match. They used to have these kind of ceremonial plowing festivals. Maybe they even still have these in Canada. They actually did. They have these like plowing fairs, or harvest fairs, right? People do these kind of country games, kind of something like that. And he was at this kind of plowing fair. I guess people were competing to plow. And he sat under a tree. And he spontaneously, as a young kid, entered into what they call the jhanas, this kind of very pleasant, rapturous states of mind that come about when you're secluded from sensual pleasures. You're just focusing on your object of meditation, more or less. And the thought came to him, you know, this isn't something unwholesome. This isn't something bad. You know, why am I afraid of this? You know, is this the way to the deathless? And so then the answer came to him, this is the way. And so when he had this realization, he was approached by this woman who offered him some food, and he took the solid food and ate it. And for all these 6 years he'd been doing ascetic practices, he'd had a group of 5 friends who were with him, doing these ascetic practices with him. And when they saw him take solid food, they got so disgusted that they left him. They thought that he'd reverted to luxury. There's actually another sutta later in the canon, which is just kind of funny when he meets them again after he's a Buddha. So then the Buddha, now you can imagine the Buddha's left home. If the legends are accurate, then he's left. He hasn't seen his family. He's given up everything. He has no wealth anymore. He doesn't know what's going on with any of his family members, any of his friends from before. And now he doesn't even have his friends who are with him practicing austerities. And the jhanas, the formless jhanas, that he practiced earlier, didn't lead him to the deathless. And one of the things we have to remember that's interesting is that at the time of the Buddha, there was no guarantee that there even was a way to end samsara, even was a way out of suffering. No guarantee. It's just this idea that people had that it might be possible. So you can imagine he was just at his wit's end, basically. There was nothing else left for him to try. And so he sat down and he made a vow that I won't get up from this seat until I die or attain enlightenment. And so that very night, when he sat down and made this vow, he broke through. And in the first watch of the night, he remembered his rebirths, going back eons and eons of world expansion, world contraction. And so the way that they usually describe it is 1 birth, 2 births, 100 births, 1,000 births, 100,000 births, many eons of world expansion, many eons of world contraction. You know, here I had a face like this. Here I had a name like this. This was my clan. This was my food. This was my experience of pleasure and pain. And when I died, I passed away from there and re-arose here. It's kind of funny. That's a quick summation of of a life. Clan, name, food, pleasure and pain, death. Kind of a summation of central pleasure that people get in their life. And so then the second watch of the night, he gained knowledge of kamma, this knowledge of kind of when beings do good actions, this is the results it leads to. When beings do bad actions, these are the results it leads to. And so in some places in the canon, it's described like a person who just sits there watching people go through these 2 revolving doors. And I don't know if they said revolving, but 2 doors, you know, in the... And so in the same way, you kind of get this image of the Buddha being able to see the actions that people had. You know, people who do good, they go like this. People who do bad, they go like this. This action leads to this result. That action leads to that result, which is one of the special things that a Buddha can do. And in the third watch of the night, he had the knowledge of the ending of effluence. In other words, he had this knowledge that birth has been destroyed, the holy life has been lived, there's nothing more to do, no more coming to any state of being. And this is what the Buddha's life was for, and this is why we're here, what the whole Buddhist religion is based on, that there is this possibility to come to an end, come to an end of suffering and stress. This is the interesting thing. Most of the work that we do in the world, most of the things that we undertake, you know, whether it's learning from the first part of the Buddha's life, whether it's pursuing dancing musicians, whether it's pursuing wealth, whether it's pursuing good health, whatever job it is, these jobs don't usually come to an end. When one person retires, another person has to go and take that job over. There's no end to it. But this is something that actually has an end. There is an end to suffering and stress. And once that end is achieved, there's nothing more to be added to what you've achieved. It's what the Buddhists call the highest thing. That's it. No more suffering and stress. And so from that point on, the Buddha went out and he taught for 45 years. He walked throughout India and basically taught kings, he taught lepers, he taught scavengers, he taught Brahmins, taught warriors, he even taught murderers. Whoever came to him and wanted to learn, if they had the capacity to learn, he would teach them. And even teach people who didn't have the capacity to learn. Teach him. And what he taught them was this way of practice that he learned, this what he learned about karma, what he learned about moving forward towards this deathless happiness. And this is something that's still relevant for us today, you know, even 2,500 years from now, or from the Buddha's death, this is something that still inspires people. I remember when I was first getting into Buddhism, and I was on a camping trip, actually, and I was reading The Life of the Buddha, and I was totally blown away and totally inspired by it. Didn't know there was anything even like this. And this is 2,500 years ago, having grown up with TV, Ninja Turtles, movies, you know, having strove for good grades, having, you know, chased pretty women. It was all the same. Still something relatable. And so at the end of the Buddha's teaching career, after having traveled for 2,500 years, after having trained many disciples, after having had many disciples who'd themselves become what they call arahants, people who'd ended suffering and stress, and in that respect were completely equal to the Buddha. No distinction between the Buddha's attainment of the end of suffering and the attainment of the end of suffering for his disciple. As he was about to die, there were several interesting things that happened. He was walking and he'd eaten this Sukara Madhava, which nobody knows what it is, but now most Buddhists kind of joke about whether it's pork, or many Buddhists joke. It was apparently this pig's delight, some kind of pork dish. And so as a monk, sometimes you people get to joking if they're, you know, if you're in India and something looks really unsavory, it was like, be careful, that might be, you know, Sukara Madhava. But the Buddha ate this Sukara Madhava, and after eating this, whatever it was, he had severe pains in his stomach. And wandering for a bit, he came to this place between these two sal trees in this town called Kusinara, which is a very small and nondescript town. And there's a couple of really inspiring things that happened before he passed away. One was his very last disciple was this old monk who was from a different sect, and he approached the Buddha, and the Buddha was about to pass away. He was very sick on his deathbed, and Ananda was guarding him, his attendant, and he said, I'd like to ask the Buddha a question. And Ananda said, now isn't the right time to ask a Buddha a question. You know, the Buddha's sick. He's on his deathbed. And say, maybe not, didn't, I don't think he said deathbed. But he asked, I think, maybe a couple of times, and then the Buddha called out from where he was and said, Ananda, let him approach. Whatever question he wants to ask me is for the sake of the Dhamma, not for the sake of troubling me. And so then he asked him this question. He said, all these different teachers teach these different things. I'm confused. How do I know what is the right teaching and what isn't? And the Buddha said, put that aside. He said, wherever there's a Noble Eightfold Path, that's where you're going to find contemplatives of the first, the second, the third, the fourth degree. In other words, that's where you find stream enterers, people who are guaranteed enlightenment within seven lifetimes, once returners, people who will guarantee it within one lifetime, non-returners, people who will never come back to the sensual world. They'll be reborn in a very high heaven, and they attain nibbana there, and arhats, people who won't come back ever, who've ended rebirth, who've ended suffering and stress. And he said, this dispensation has a Noble Eightfold Path, and it's only in this dispensation that these four types of people are found. So then this person was very inspired. He said, I want to join the Sangha. And the Buddha said, okay, usually there's a four-month waiting period, but there's distinctions, and I think he let him ordain right away. And so he ordained in the Buddha's presence. I think he said Ehi Bhikkhu, which means come Bhikkhu. And so that was the Buddha's last disciple, ordained by the Buddha. And he became an arahant in no long time after that. And so then as the Buddha was about to die, all these kind of heavenly flowers in the Deva worlds are said to have these very beautiful, extremely beautiful flowers. And it's only mentioned briefly, but they have these trees that kind of go through a period where they have this incredible floral display. And when they have this incredible floral display, then all the Devas come out and party. And these heavenly flowers started raining down on the Buddha. And this was the Deva's way of honoring him. And I think they were playing celestial music too. And the Buddha said, there is this way to honor the Tathagata. This is what they call Amisa Puja, kind of offering flowers. But the better way to honor the Tathagata is to practice the Dhamma in line with the Dhamma. In other words, to put his teachings into practice. I was sitting here now meditating, this kind of thing. This was a second inspiring thing. And so then as the Buddha was about to pass away, what he said was, does anybody have any questions? This is another interesting thing about the Buddha's life story. We most of the time know his last words, but his second to last words were to make sure that if anybody had any questions, they should ask them. It shows the importance of asking questions in the Buddha's eyes. And nobody did. But it was because all of them were, the least of them were stream winners. The least of them there were stream winners. So they'd already pretty much had most of their doubts cleared up. And then before the Buddha passed away, what he said was, his last words were, Bhikkhus, I declare to you this, all conditioned phenomena are impermanent. Strive for the goal with diligence. And those were the Buddha's last words. And he entered the first jhana, the second jhana, the third jhana, the fourth jhana. He entered, what's next after, I think, the base of nothingness, the base of infinite consciousness, base of infinite space, base of infinite consciousness, base of neither perception or non-perception, and then the cessation of perception and feeling, which is the highest meditative attainment you can get. And he went back down in reverse order. And when he hit the first, fourth jhana, he died. He attained parinibbana. But before the Buddha passed away, many people had asked him, they'd said, his cousin wanted him to appoint a successor. But the Buddha said, when I pass away, don't think that you don't have a leader or a teacher in the Sangha anymore. When I pass away, your leader and teacher will be the Dhamma and the Vinaya that I've left for you. So he never left an heir. What he left in charge was his teachings. What he left in charge were the suttas, his descriptions on how to practice, and for monks, the Vinaya. This is one of the last things we have. So the Buddha's great gift to us is something that's still available to us today. The teachings are actually still here. We still have the suttas. Still have the Vinaya, and there are even in the world still members of the Arya Sangha, members who practice the path till its end. People who we can go and train under, people who we can ask questions of. And so the gates of the deathless are still open. What the Buddha says, the wheel of Dhamma that he set in motion, that he set rolling 2,500 years ago, is still in motion, it's still rolling. Even today, even 2,500 years ago, even in Canada, there's video games, it's automobiles, with its CN Tower. These things are eternal truths. These are laws that are ancient and inexhaustible. Whatever is subject to origination is subject to ceasing. When a person sees this with wisdom, they wear away their defilements. When a person truly pierces this through with wisdom, then they know for themselves that they have only 7 lifetimes left, fixed in their destiny, incapable of doing certain bad actions, assured of good rebirths. And these are things that these are the fruits of the path that we can all gain for ourselves in the same way that they did 2,500 years ago. It just starts with this. It starts with learning to follow the precepts, learning to become a giving person, learning to sit down and watch our breath, learning to take our mind to the objects that we choose instead of the objects we desire, gaining more and more control over what we do, over what we think, over what we say, over how we act, you know, so that we can make the good kamma that will take us forward, you know, on the path, that will help us build up the path. And so this is kind of one of the metaphors that a famous teacher in Thailand gives, like climbing a ladder, you know. So you grab one rung and the next rung and the next rung and the next rung, and to climb up. And it's only at the top when you let everything go. So it's for this sake. It's for the sake of this ending of conditions, for the cessation of suffering, you know, for removing the crossbar, for filling in the moat that the Buddha left home 2,500 years ago. It's for that sake that he practiced asceticism. It's for that sake that even when his friends abandoned him, he didn't give up. It's for that sake that he sat that night under the Bodhi tree and made that vow, I won't get up until I find a way to end suffering. And it's for that sake that he taught for 45 years, you know, that even on his deathbed, he let somebody ordain. It's for that sake that he left the suttas and the Vinaya in charge. This is still our leader today. And it's for that sake that he left his last words with us. They're still with us today. All conditioned phenomena are subject to decay. Strive for the goal with diligence. So for 2,500 years, those words have rang down. They've echoed down. And they've inspired people to practice. They've inspired people to make the changes in their lives that will make their lives good. They've inspired people to strive for the noble attainments, for the attainments that actually take us beyond. And when people have these attainments, when people go beyond, they become an island for themselves. They become a refuge for themselves. They become a refuge that no other flood can overwhelm. And at the end of the path, they know what the Buddha knows. Become independent of everything. So this is a true message of the Buddha's life. And something that's worth thinking about, something that's good to contemplate on Vaisak. So I think I'll leave that for your reflection. And happy Vaisak!